He paused. They're burning the bodies at Salem and Nashua. That's what these folks told me. And it smells like a pig roast. They told me that, too. I've got a party of five I'm taking west, and we want to make some miles before sunup. The way west is open.
That's the word you're hearing, is it? Clay asked.
Hant looked at him with mild contempt.
That's the word, all right. And a word to the wise is sufficient, my ma used to say.
If you really mean to go north, make sure you get to the border in the middle of the night. The crazies don't go out after dark.
We know, Tom said. The man with the flashlights affixed to the sides of his head ignored Tom and went on talking to Clay. He had pegged Clay as the trio's leader.
And they don't carry flashlights. Wave your flashlights back and forth. Talk, yell, they don't do those things either. I doubt the people at the border will let you through, but if you're lucky, they won't shoot you either.
They're getting smarter, Alice said. You know that, don't you, Mr. Hant?
Hant snorted.
They're traveling in packs and they're not killing each other anymore. I don't know if that makes them smarter or not. But they're still killing us, I know that.
Hant must have seen doubt on Clay's face because he smiled. His flashlights turned it into something unpleasant.
I saw them catch a woman out this morning, he said. With my own eyes, okay?
Clay nodded.
Okay.
I think I know why she was on the street. This was in Topsfield, about 10 miles east of here. Me and my people, we were in a Motel 6. She was walking that way, only not really walking, hurrying, almost running, looking back over her shoulder. I saw her because I couldn't sleep.
He shook his head.
Getting used to sleeping days is a bitch.
Clay thought of telling Hant they'd all get used to it, then didn't. He saw Alice was holding her talisman again. He didn't want Alice hearing this and knew there was no way to keep her from it. Partly because it was survival information, and unlike the stuff about the New Hampshire state line, he was almost positive this was solid information. Partly because the world was going to be full of stories like this for a while. If they listened to enough of them, some might eventually begin to line up and make patterns.
Probably just looking for a better place to stay, you know? No more than that. Saw the Motel 6 and thought, hey, a room with a bed, right up there by the Exxon station, only a block away. But before she got even halfway, a bunch of them came around the corner. They were walking. You know how they walk now.
Roscoe Hant walked toward them stiffly, like a tin soldier, with his newsboy's bag swinging. That wasn't how the phone crazies walked, but they knew what he was trying to convey by it, and nodded.
And she...
He leaned back against the overturned truck and scrubbed briefly at his face with his hands.
This is what I want you to understand, okay? This is why you can't get caught out, can't get fooled that they're getting normal because every now and then one or two of them is lucked into hitting the right controls on a boombox and started a CD playing.
You've seen that? Tom asked. Heard that?
Yeah, twice. Second guy I saw was walking along, swinging the thing from side to side so hard in his arms that it was skipping like hell. But yeah, it was playing.
So they like music, and sure, they might be retrieving some of their marbles, but that's exactly why you have to be careful, see?
What happened to the woman? Alice asked. The one who got caught out.
She tried to act like one of them, Hant said. And I thought, standing there at the window of the room where I was, I thought, yeah, you go, girl. You might have a chance if you can hang on to that act a little while and then make a break, get inside somewhere. Because they don't like to go inside places, have you noticed that?
Clay, Tom, and Alice shook their heads. The man nodded.
They will. I've seen them do it. But they don't like to.
How did they get on to her?
Alice asked again.
I don't exactly know. They smelled her or something.
Or maybe touched her thoughts, Tom said.
Or couldn't touch them, Alice said.
I don't know about any of that, Hant said. But I know they tore her apart in the street. I mean literally tore her to pieces.
And this happened when? Clay asked. He saw Alice was swaying and put an arm around her.
9 this morning, in Topsfield. So if you see a bunch of them walking up the yellow brick road with a boombox that's playing Why Can't We Be Friends?
He surveyed them grimly by the glow of the flashlights strapped to the sides of his head.
I wouldn't go running out yelling Kemo Sabe, that's all.
He paused.
And I wouldn't go north either. Even if they don't shoot you at the border, it's a waste of time.
But after a little consultation at the edge of the IGA parking lot, they went north anyway. Chapter 6 They paused near North Andover,
standing on a pedestrian overpass above Route 495. The clouds were thickening again, but the moon broke through long enough to show them six lanes of silent traffic. Near the bridge where they stood, in the southbound lanes, an overturned 16-wheeler lay like a dead elephant. Orange pylons had been set up around it, showing that someone had made at least a token response, and there were two abandoned police cruisers beyond them, one on its side. The rear half of the truck had been burned black. There was no sign of bodies, not in the momentary moonlight. A few people labored westward in the breakdown lane, but it was slow going even there.
"Kind of makes it all real, doesn't it?" Tom said.
"No," Alice said. She sounded indifferent.
"To me it looks like a special effect in some big summer movie. Buy a bucket of popcorn and a Coke and watch the end of the world and... what do they call it? Computer graphic imaging? CGI? Blue screen? Some fucking thing."
She held up the little sneaker by one lace.
"This is all I need to make it real. Something small enough to hold in my hand. Come on, let's go."
Chapter 7. There were plenty of abandoned vehicles on Highway 28, but it was wide open compared to 495, and by 4 o'clock they were nearing Methuen, hometown of Mr. Roscoe Hant, he of the stereo flashlights. And they believed enough of Hant's story to want to be undercover well before daylight. They chose a motel at the intersection of 28 and 110. A dozen or so cars were parked in front of the various units, but to Clay they had an abandoned feel. And why wouldn't they? The two roads were passable, but only if you were on foot. Clay and Tom stood at the edge of the parking lot, waving their flashlights over their heads.
"We're okay," Tom called. "Normal folks. Coming in."
They waited. There was no response from what the sign identified as the Sweet Valley Inn, heated pool, HBO, group rates.
"Come on," Alice said. "My feet hurt. And it'll be getting light soon, won't it?"
"Look at this," Clay said. He picked up a CD from the motel's turn-in and shone the beam of his flashlight on it. It was Love Songs by Michael Bolton.
"And you said they were getting smarter," Tom said.
"Don't be so quick to judge," Clay said as they started toward the units. "Whoever had it threw it away, right?"
"More likely just dropped it," Tom said.
Alice shone her own light on the CD.
"Who is this guy?"
"Honey Bunch," Tom said. "You don't want to know." He took the CD and tossed it back over his shoulder. They forced the doors on three adjoining units, as gently as possible, so they could at least shoot the bolts once they were inside, and with beds to sleep in, they slept most of the day away. They were not disturbed, although that evening Alice said she thought she had heard music coming from far away. But she admitted it might have been part of a dream she was having. Chapter 8. There were maps for sale in the lobby of the Sweet Valley Inn that would offer more detail than their road atlas. They were in a glass display cabinet that had been smashed. Clay took one for Massachusetts and one for New Hampshire, reaching in carefully so as not to cut his hand, and saw a young man lying on the other side of the reception counter as he did so. His eyes glared sightlessly. For a moment, Clay thought someone had put an oddly colored corsage in the corpse's mouth. Then he saw the greenish points poking out through the dead man's cheeks and realized they matched the broken glass littering the shelves of the display cabinet. The corpse was wearing a name tag that said, "My name is Hank. Ask me about weekly rates." Clay thought briefly of Mr. Riccardi as he looked at Hank. Tom and Alice were waiting for him just inside the lobby door. It was 9:15, and outside it was full dark.
"How did you do?"
Alice asked.
"These may help," he said.
He gave her the maps, then lifted the Coleman lantern so she and Tom could study them, compare them against the road atlas, and plot the night's travel. He was trying to cultivate a sense of fatalism about Johnny and Sharon, trying to keep the bald truth of his current family situation front and center in his mind. What had happened in Kent Pond had happened. His son and his wife were either all right, or they weren't. He would either find them, or he wouldn't. His success at this sort of semi-magical thinking came and went. When it started slipping, he told himself he was lucky to be alive, and this was certainly true. What balanced his good luck out was that he'd been in Boston, 150 miles south of Kent Pond by even the quickest route, which they were definitely not taking, when the pulse happened. And yet he'd fallen in with good people. There was that. People he could think of as friends. He'd seen plenty of others, beer keg guy and plump Bible-toting lady, as well as Mr. Roscoe Hant of Methuen, who weren't as lucky.
If he got to you, Cher, if Johnny got to you, you better be taking care of him. You just better be.
But suppose he'd had his phone. Suppose he'd taken the red cell phone to school.
Might he not have been
taking it a little more often lately? Because so many of the other kids took theirs? Christ. Clay? You all right? Tom asked.
Sure, why?
I don't know, you looked a little grim.
Dead guy behind the counter. He's not pretty.
Look here, Alice said, tracing a thread on the map. It squiggled across the state line and then appeared to join New Hampshire Route 38, a little east of Pelham.
That looks pretty good to me, she said.
If we go west on the highway out there for 8 or 9 miles, she pointed at 110, where both the cars and the tar were gleaming faintly in a misty drizzle.
We should hit it. What do you think?
I think that sounds good, Tom said. She looked from him to Clay anxiously. The little sneaker was put away, probably in her backpack, but Clay could see her wanting to squeeze it. He supposed it was good she wasn't a smoker. She'd be up to 4 packs a day.
If they've got the way across guarded, she began.
We'll worry about that if we have to, Clay said, but he wasn't worrying. One way or another, he was getting to Maine. If it meant crawling through some pucker brush, like an illegal crossing the Canadian border to pick apples in October, he would do it. If Tom and Alice decided to stay behind, that would be too bad. He'd be sorry to leave them, but he would go, because he had to know. The red squiggle Alice had found on the Sweet Valley maps had a name, Dosty Stream Road, and it was almost wide open. It was a 4-mile hike to the state line, and they came upon no more than 5 or 6 abandoned vehicles and only a single wreck. They also passed 2 houses where they could see lights and hear the roar of generators. They considered stopping at these, but not for long.
We'd probably get into a firefight with some guy defending his hearth and home, Clay said, always assuming there's anyone there. Those generators were probably set to come on when the county juice failed, and they'll run until they're out of gas.
Even if there are sane people and they let us in, which would hardly be a sane act, what are we going to do? Tom said. Ask to use the phone?
They discussed stopping somewhere and trying to liberate a vehicle. Liberate was Tom's word, but in the end decided against that too. If the state line was being defended by deputies or vigilantes, driving up to it in a Chevy Tahoe might not be the smoothest move.
So they walked. And of course, there was nothing at the state line but a billboard. A small one, as befitted a 2-lane blacktop road winding through farm country, reading, "You are now entering New Hampshire," and "Bienvenue." There was no sound but the drip of moisture in the woods on either side of them, and an occasional sigh of breeze, maybe the rustle of an animal. They stopped briefly to read the sign, and then walked on, leaving Massachusetts behind.
Chapter 9.
Any sense of being alone ended along with the Dosty Stream Road, at a signpost reading New Hampshire Route 38, and Manchester, 19 miles. There were still only a few travelers on 38, but when they switched to 128, a wide, wreck-littered road that headed almost due north, half an hour later, that trickle became part of a steady stream of refugees. They traveled mostly in little groups of 3 and 4, and with what struck Clay as a rather shabby lack of interest in anyone other than themselves. They encountered a woman of about 40 and a man maybe 20 years older, pushing shopping carts, each containing a child. The one in the man's cart was a boy and too big for the conveyance, but he had found a way to curl up inside and fall asleep. While Clay and his party were passing this jackleg family, a wheel came off the man's shopping cart. It tipped sideways, spilling out the boy, who looked about 7. Tom caught him by the shoulder and broke the worst of the kid's fall, but he scraped 1 knee, and of course he was frightened. Tom picked him up, but the boy didn't know him and struggled to get away, crying harder than ever.
"That's okay, thanks. I've got him," the man said.
He took the child and sat down at the side of the road with him, where he made much of what he called the boo-boo, a term Clay didn't think he'd heard since he was 7. The man said, "Gregory, kiss it. Make it all better." He kissed the child's scrape, and the boy laid his head against the man's shoulder. He was already going to sleep again. Gregory smiled at Tom and Clay and nodded. He looked weary almost to death, a man who might have been a trim and nautilus-toned 60 last week, and now looked like a 75-year-old Jew trying to get the hell out of Poland while there was still time. "We'll be all right," he said. "You can go now." Clay opened his mouth to say, "Why shouldn't we all go on together? Why don't we hook up? What do you think, Greg?" It was the sort of thing the heroes of the science fiction novels he'd read as a teenager were always saying. "Why don't we hook up?" "Yeah, go on. What are you waiting for?" the woman asked before he could say that or anything else. In her shopping cart, a girl of about 5 still slept. The woman stood beside the cart protectively, as if she had grabbed some fabulous sale item and was afraid Clay or one of his friends might try to wrest it from her. "You think we got something you want?" "Natalie, stop," Gregory said with tired patience. But Natalie didn't, and Clay realized what was so dispiriting about this little scene. Not that he was getting his lunch, his midnight lunch, fed to him by a woman whose exhaustion and terror had led to paranoia. That was understandable and forgivable. What made his spirits sink to his shoe tops was the way people just kept on walking, swinging their flashlights, and talking low among themselves in their own little groups, swapping the occasional suitcase from one hand to the other. Some yob on a pocket rocket motorbike wove his way up the road between the wrecks and over the litter, and people made way for him, muttering resentfully. Clay thought it would have been the same if the little boy had fallen out of the shopping cart and broken his neck instead of just scraping his knee. He thought it would have been the same if that heavyset guy up there panting along the side of the road with an overloaded duffel bag dropped with a thunderclap coronary. No one would try to resuscitate him, and of course the days of 911 were done. No one even bothered to yell, "You tell him, lady," or, "Hey, dude, why don't you tell her to shut up?" They just went on walking. "'Cause all we got is these kids, a responsibility we didn't ask for when we can hardly take care of ourselves. He has a pacemaker. What are we supposed to do when the battery runs out, I'd like to know? And now these kids? You want a kid?" She looked around wildly. "Hey, anyone want a kid?" The little girl began to stir. "Natalie, you're disturbing Portia," Gregory said. The woman named Natalie began to laugh. "Well, tough shit. It's a disturbing-ass world." Around them, people continued doing the refugee walk. No one paid any attention, and Clay thought, "So this is how we act. This is how it goes when the bottom drops out. When there are no cameras turning, no buildings burning, no Anderson Cooper saying, 'Now back to the CNN studios in Atlanta.' This is how it goes when Homeland Security's been canceled due to lack of sanity." "Let me take the boy," Clay said. "I'll carry him until you find something better to put him in. That cart's shot." He looked at Tom. Tom shrugged and nodded. "Stay away from us," Natalie said, and all at once there was a gun in her hand. It wasn't a big one, probably only a .22, but even a .22 would do the job if the bullet went in the right place. Clay heard the sound of guns being drawn on either side of him, and knew that Tom and Alice were now pointing the pistols they'd taken from the Nickerson home at the woman named Natalie. This was also how it went, it seemed. "Put it away, Natalie," he said. "We're going to get moving now." "You're double fucking right you are," she said, and brushed an errant lock of hair out of her eye with the heel of her free hand. She didn't seem to be aware that the young man and younger woman with Clay were holding guns on her. Now people passing by did look, but their only response was to move past the spot of confrontation and potential bloodshed a little faster. "Come on, Clay," Alice said quietly. She put her free hand on his wrist. "Before someone gets shot." They started walking again. Alice walked with her hand on Clay's wrist, almost as if he were her boyfriend. Just a little midnight stroll, Clay thought, although he had no idea of what time it was and didn't care. His heart was beating hard. Tom walked with them, only until they were around the next curve he walked backward, with his gun still out. Clay supposed Tom wanted to be ready to shoot back if Natalie decided to use her little pop gun after all. Because shooting back was also how it went, now that phone service had been interrupted until further notice. Chapter 10. In the hours before dawn, walking on Route 102 east of Manchester, they began to hear music, very faint.
"Christ," Tom said, coming to a stop. "That's Baby Elephant Walk."
"It's what?" Alice asked. She sounded amused.
"A big band instrumental from the age of Quarter Gas. Les Brown and his Band of Renown, someone like that. My mother had the record."
Two men pulled even with them and stopped for a blow. They were elderly, but both looked fit. Like a couple of recently retired postmen hiking the Cotswolds, Clay thought. Wherever they are. One wore a pack, no pussy day pack either, but the waist-length kind on a frame, and the other had a rucksack hanging from his right shoulder. Hung over the left was what looked like a 30-30. Packsack wiped sweat from his seamed forehead with a forearm and said,
"Your mama might have had a version by Les Brown, son, but more likely it was Don Costa or Henry Mancini. Those were the popular ones. That one," he inclined his head toward the ghostly strains, "that's Lawrence Welk, as I live and breathe."
"Lawrence Welk?" Tom breathed, almost in awe.
"Who?"
Alice asked. "Listen to that elephant walk," Clay said, and laughed. He was tired and feeling goofy. It occurred to him that Johnny would love that music. Packsack gave him a glance of passing contempt, then looked back at Tom.
"That's Lawrence Welk, all right," he said. "My eyes aren't half right anymore, but my ears are fine. My wife and I used to watch his show every fucking Saturday night."
"Dodge had a good time, too," Rucksack said. It was his only addition to the conversation, and Clay hadn't the slightest idea what it meant.
"Lawrence Welk and his champagne band," Tom said. "Think of it."
"Lawrence Welk and his champagne music makers," Packsack said. "Jesus Christ."
"Don't forget the Lennon sisters and the lovely Alice Lawn," Tom said.
In the distance, the ghostly music changed.
"That one's Calcutta," Packsack said.
He sighed.
"Well, we'll be getting along. Nice passing the time of day with you."
"Night," Clay said.
"Nope," Packsack said. "These are our days now. Haven't you noticed? Have a good one, boys. You too, little ma'am."
"Thank you," the little ma'am standing between Clay and Tom said faintly. Packsack started along again. Rucksack fell sturdily in beside him. Around them, a steady parade of bobbing flashlight beams led people deeper into New Hampshire. Then Packsack stopped and looked back for a final word.
"You don't want to be on the road more than another hour," he said. "Find a house or motel unit and get inside. You know about the shoes, right?"
"What about the shoes?" Tom asked. Packsack looked at him patiently, the way he'd probably look at anyone who couldn't help being a fool. Far down the road, Calcutta, if that's what it was, had given way to a polka. It sounded insane in the foggy, drizzly night. And now this old man with the big pack on his back was talking about shoes.
"When you go inside a place, you put your shoes out on the stoop," Packsack said. "The crazy ones won't take them, don't worry about that. And it tells other people the place is taken and to move along, find another.
Saves—" his eyes dropped to the heavy automatic weapon Clay was carrying.
"Saves accidents."
"Have there been accidents?" Tom asked.
"Oh, yes," Packsack said, with chilling indifference. "There's always accidents, people being what they are. But there's plenty of places, so there's no need for you to have one. Just put out your shoes."
"How do you know that?" Alice asked. He gave her a smile that improved his face out of all measure, but it was hard not to smile at Alice. She was young, and even at 3 in the morning she was pretty.
"People talk, I listen. I talk, sometimes other folks listen. Did you listen?"
"Yes," Alice said. "Listening's one of my best things."
"Then pass it on. Bad enough to have them to contend with."
He didn't have to be more specific.
"Too bad to have accidents among ourselves on top of that."
Clay thought of Natalie pointing the .22. He said, "You're right, thank you." Tom said,
"That one's the beer barrel polka, isn't it?"
"That's right, son," Packsack said. "Myron Florin on the squeeze box, God rest his soul. You might want to stop in Gayton. It's a nice little village 2 miles or so up the road."
"Is that where you're going to stay?" Alice asked.
Me and Rolf might push on a dite further, he said.
Why?
Because we can, little ma'am, that's all. You have a good day.
This time they didn't contradict him, and although the two men had to be pushing 70, they were soon out of sight, following the beam of a single flashlight which Rucksack, Rolf, held.
Lawrence Welk and his champagne music makers, Tom marveled.
Baby elephant walk, Clay said, and laughed.
Why did Dodge have a good time, too?
Alice wanted to know.
Because it could, I guess, Tom said,
and burst out laughing at her perplexed expression. Chapter 11 The music was coming from Gayton, the nice little village Packsack had recommended as a place to stop. It was not nearly as loud as the AC/DC concert Clay had gone to in Boston as a teenager. That had left his ears ringing for days. But it was loud enough to make him think of summer band concerts he'd attended in South Berwick with his parents. In fact, he had it in his mind that they would discover the source of the music on the Gayton Town Common. Likely some elderly person, not a phone crazy but disaster-addled, who had taken it into his head to serenade the ongoing exodus with easy-listening oldies played through a set of battery-powered loudspeakers. There was a Gayton Town Common, but it was deserted, save for a few people eating either a late supper or an early breakfast by the glow of flashlights and Coleman lanterns. The source of the music was a little farther to the north. By then, Lawrence Welk had given way to someone blowing a horn so mellow it was soporific.
That's Wynton Marsalis, isn't it?
Clay asked. He was ready to call it quits for the night, and thought Alice looked done almost to death.
Him or Kenny G, Tom said. You know what Kenny G said when he got off the elevator, don't you?
No, Clay said, but I'm sure you'll tell me.
Man, this place rocks!
Clay said. That's so funny I think my sense of humor just imploded.
I don't get it, Alice said.
It's not worth explaining, Tom said. Listen, guys, we've got to call it a night. I'm about kilt.
Me too, Alice said. I thought I was in shape from soccer, but I'm really tired.
Yeah, Clay agreed. Baby makes three. They had already passed through Gayton's shopping district, and according to the signs, Main Street, which was also Route 102, had now become Academy Avenue. This was no surprise to Clay because the sign on the outskirts of town had proclaimed Gayton home to historic Gayton Academy, an institution of which Clay had heard vague rumors. He thought it was one of those New England prep schools for kids who can't quite make it into Exeter or Milton. He supposed the three of them would be back in the land of Burger Kings, muffler repair shops, and chain motels soon enough, but this part of New Hampshire 102 was lined with very nice-looking homes. The problem was, there were shoes, sometimes as many as four pairs, in front of most of the doors. The foot traffic had thinned considerably as other travelers found shelter for the coming day, but as they passed Academy Grove Sitco and approached the fieldstone pillars flanking Gayton Academy's entrance drive, they began to catch up to a trio just ahead, two men and a woman, all well into middle age. As these three walked slowly up the sidewalk, they inspected each house for one without shoes placed at the front door. The woman was limping badly, and one of the men had his arm around her waist. Gayton Academy was on the left, and Clay realized this was where the music, currently a droning, string-laden version of Fly Me to the Moon, was coming from. He noticed two other things. One was that the road litter here, torn bags, half-eaten vegetables, gnawed bones, was especially heavy, and that most of it turned in at the gravel Academy Drive. The other was that two people were standing there. One was an old man, hunched over a cane. The other was a boy with a battery-powered lantern parked between his shoes. He looked no more than 12 and was dozing against one of the pillars. He was wearing what looked like a school uniform, gray pants, gray sweater, a maroon jacket with a crest on it. As the trio ahead of Clay and his friends drew abreast of the Academy Drive, the old man, dressed in a tweed jacket with patches on the elbows, spoke to them in a piercing, "I will be heard all the way to the back of the lecture hall" voice.
"Hi there. Hi, I say. Won't you come in here? We can offer you shelter, but more importantly, we have to—"
"We don't have anything, mister," the woman said. I got 4 burst blisters, 2 on each foot, and I can hardly walk.
But there's plenty of room,
the old fellow began. The man supporting the woman gave him a look that must have been unpleasant, because the old fellow stopped. The trio went past the drive, and the pillars, and the sign on old-fashioned iron S-hooks reading, Gayton Academy, established 1846. A young mind is a lamp in the darkness. The old fellow slumped over his cane again, then saw Clay, Tom, and Alice approaching, and straightened up once more. He seemed about to hail them, and then apparently decided his lecture hall approach wasn't working. He poked his companion in the ribs with the tip of his cane instead. The boy straightened up with a wild look, as behind them, where brick buildings loomed in the dark along the slope of a mild hill, Fly Me to the Moon gave way to an equally sluggish rendition of something that might once have been I Get a Kick Out of You.
Jordan, he said, your turn. Ask them in.
The boy named Jordan started, blinked at the old man, then looked at the new trio of approaching strangers with gloomy mistrust. Clay thought of the March Hare and the Dormouse in Alice in Wonderland. Maybe that was wrong. Probably it was. But he was very tired.
Oh, they won't be any different, sir, he said. They won't come in. Nobody will. We'll try again tomorrow night. I'm sleepy.
And Clay knew that, tired or not, they were going to find out what the old man wanted, unless Tom and Alice absolutely refused, that was. Partly because the old man's companion reminded him of Johnny, yes. But mostly because the kid had made up his mind that no one was going to help in this not very brave new world. He and the one he called Sir were on their own, because that was just how it went. Only if that were true, pretty soon there wouldn't be anything worth saving.
Go on,
the old man encouraged him. He prodded Jordan with the tip of his cane again, but not hard, not painfully.
Tell them we can give them shelter. We have plenty of room, but they ought to see first. Someone needs to see this. If they also say no, we will indeed give up for the night.
All right, sir.
The old man smiled, exposing a mouthful of large horse teeth.
Thank you, Jordan.
The boy walked toward them with absolutely no relish, his dusty shoes scuffing, his shirt tail hanging below the hem of his sweater. He held his lantern in one hand, and it fizzed faintly. There were dark, up-all-night circles under his eyes, and his hair badly needed washing. Tom? Clay asked.
We'll see what he wants, Tom said. Because I can see it's what you want, but...
Sirs? Pardon me, sirs?
1 second, Tom said to the boy, then turned back to Clay. His face was grave.
But it's going to start getting light in an hour, maybe less. So that old guy better be right about there being a place for us to stay.
Oh, yes, sir,
Jordan said. He looked like he didn't want to hope and couldn't help it.
Lots of places. Hundreds of dorm rooms, not to mention Cheatham Lodge. Tobias Wolfe came last year and stayed there. He gave a lecture on his book, Old School.
I read that, Alice said, sounding bemused.
The boys who didn't have cell phones have all run off. The ones who did have them...
We know about them, Alice said.
I'm a scholarship boy. I lived in Holloway. I didn't have a cell phone. I used to use the dorm mother's phone whenever I wanted to call home, and the other boys would make fun of me.
Looks to me like you got the last laugh there, Jordan, Tom said.
Yes, sir,
he said dutifully. But in the light of his fizzing lantern, Clay saw no laughter, only woe and weariness.
Won't you please come and meet the head?
And although he had to be very tired himself, Tom responded with complete politeness, as if they had been standing on a sunny veranda, at a parent's tea, perhaps, instead of on the trash-littered verge of Academy Avenue at 4:15 in the morning.
That would be our pleasure, Jordan, he said.
Chapter 12.
The devil's intercoms is what I used to call them,
said Charles Ardai, who had been chairman of Gayton Academy's English department for 25 years and acting headmaster of the academy entire at the time of the pulse. Now he stumped with surprising rapidity up the hill on his cane, keeping to the sidewalk, avoiding the river of swill that carpeted Academy Drive. Jordan walked watchfully beside him, the other three behind him. Jordan was worried about the old man losing his balance. Clay was worried that the man might have a heart attack, trying to talk and climb a hill, even a relatively mild one like this, at the same time.
I never really meant it, of course. It was a joke, a jape, a comic exaggeration, but in truth, I never liked the things, especially in an academic environment. I might have moved to keep them out of the school, but naturally I would have been overruled. Might as well try to legislate against the rising of the tide, eh?
He puffed rapidly several times.
My brother gave me one for my 65th birthday. I ran the thing flat,
puff, pant,
and simply never recharged it. They emit radiation, are you aware of this? In minuscule amounts, it's true, but still, a source of radiation that's close to one's head, one's brain.
Sir, you should wait until we get to Tunny, Jordan said. He steadied Ardai as the head's cane slid on a rotten piece of fruit, and he listed momentarily, but at an alarming angle, to port. Probably a good idea, Clay said.
Yes, the head agreed. Only I never trusted them. This is my point. I was never that way with my computer. Took to that like a duck to water.
At the top of the hill, the campus's main road split in a Y. The left fork wound its way to buildings that were almost surely dorms. The right one went toward lecture halls, a cluster of administration buildings, and an archway that glimmered white in the dark. The river of garbage and discarded wrappers flowed beneath it. Headmaster Ardai led them that way, skirting as much of the litter as he could, Jordan holding his elbow. The music, now Bette Midler singing Wind Beneath My Wings, was coming from beyond the arch, and Clay saw dozens of discarded compact discs among the bones and empty potato chip bags. He was starting to get a bad feeling about this.
Sir?
Headmaster? Maybe we should just...
We'll be fine, the head replied. Did you ever play musical chairs as a child? Of course you did. Well, as long as the music doesn't stop, we have nothing to worry about. We'll have a quick peek, and then we'll go over to Cheatham Lodge. That's the headmaster's residence, not 200 yards from Tunny Field, I promise you.
Clay looked at Tom, who shrugged. Alice nodded. Jordan happened to be looking back at them, rather anxiously, and he caught this collegial interplay.
You ought to see it, he told them. The head's right about that. Until you see it, you don't know.
See what, Jordan?
Alice asked. But Jordan only looked at her, big young eyes in the dark.
Wait,
he said.
Chapter 13.
Holy fucking shit,
Clay said. In his mind, the word sounded like a full-throated bellow of surprise and horror, with maybe a soupçon of outrage, but what actually emerged was more of a whipped whimper. Part of it might have been that this close the music was almost as loud as that long-ago AC/DC concert, although Debbie Boone making her sweet schoolgirl way through You Light Up My Life was quite a stretch from Hell's Bells, even at full volume. But mostly it was pure shock. He thought that after the Pulse and their subsequent retreat from Boston, he'd be prepared for anything. But he was wrong. He didn't think prep schools like this indulged in anything so plebeian and so smash-mouth as football, but soccer had apparently been a big deal. The stands stacking up on either side of Tunney Field looked as if they could seat as many as 1,000, and they were decked with bunting that was only now beginning to look bedraggled by the showery weather of the last few days. There was an elaborate scoreboard at the far end of the field, with big letters marching along the top. Clay couldn't read the message in the dark, and probably wouldn't have taken it in, even if it had been daylight. There was enough light to see the field itself, and that was all that mattered. Every inch of grass was covered with phone crazies. They were lying on their backs like sardines in a can, leg to leg, and hip to hip, and shoulder to shoulder. Their faces stared up into the black, pre-dawn sky.
"Oh, my Lord Jesus," Tom said.
His voice was muffled because one fist was pressed against his mouth.
"Catch the girl," the head rapped. "She's going to faint."
"No, I'm all right," Alice said, but when Clay put his arm around her, she slumped against him, breathing fast. Her eyes were open, but they had a fixed, druggy look.
"They're under the bleachers, too," Jordan said.
He spoke with a studied, almost showy calm that Clay did not believe for a minute. It was the voice of a boy assuring his pals that he's not grossed out by the maggots boiling in a dead cat's eyes, just before he leans over and blows his groceries.
"Me and the head think that's where they put the hurt ones that aren't going to get better."
"The head and I, Jordan,
Sorry, sir.
Debbie Boone achieved poetic catharsis and ceased. There was a pause, and then Lawrence Welk's Champagne Music Makers once more began to play Baby Elephant Walk. Dodge had a good time, too, Clay thought.
How many of those boomboxes have they got rigged together? He asked Headmaster Ardai. And how did they do it? They're brainless, for Christ's sake. Zombies.
A terrible idea occurred to him, illogical and persuasive at the same time.
Did you do it? To keep them quiet, or... I don't know.
He didn't do it, Alice said.
She spoke quietly from her safe place within the circle of Clay's arm.
No, and both of your premises are wrong, the head told him.
Both?
They must be dedicated music lovers, Tom mused. Because they don't like to go inside buildings. But that's where the CDs are, right?
Not to mention the boomboxes, Clay said.
There's no time to explain now. Already the sky has begun to lighten and... Tell them, Jordan.
Jordan replied dutifully, with the air of one who recites a lesson he does not understand.
All good vampires must be in before cockcrow, sir.
That's right, before cockcrow. For now, only look. That's all you need to do. You didn't know there were places like this, did you?
Alice knew, Clay said. They looked, and because the night had begun to wane, Clay realized that the eyes in all those faces were open. He was pretty sure they weren't seeing. They were just open.
Something bad's going on here, he thought. The flocking was only the beginning of it.
Looking at the packed bodies and empty faces, mostly white, this was New England, after all, was awful. But the blank eyes turned up to the night sky filled him with unreasoning horror. Somewhere, not too distant, the morning's first bird began to sing. It wasn't a crow, but the head still jerked, then tottered. This time it was Tom who steadied him.
Come on, the head told him. It's only a short walk to Cheatham Lodge, but we ought to start. The damp has made me stiffer than ever. Take my elbow, Jordan.
Alice broke free of Clay and went to the old man's other side. He gave her a rather forbidding smile and a shake of his head.
Jordan can take care of me. We take care of each other now. Hey, Jordan?
Yes, sir.
Jordan? Tom asked. They were nearing a large and rather pretentious Tudor-style dwelling that Clay presumed was Cheatham Lodge.
Sir?
The sign over the scoreboard. I couldn't read it.
What did it say? Welcome, alumni, to homecoming weekend.
Jordan almost smiled, then remembered there would be no homecoming weekend this year. The bunting on the stands had already begun to tatter, and the brightness left his face. If he hadn't been so tired, he might still have held his composure, but it was very late, almost dawn. And as they made their way up the walk to the headmaster's residence, the last student at Gayton Academy, still wearing his colors of maroon and gray, burst into tears. Chapter 14.
That was incredible, sir, Clay said.
He had fallen into Jordan's mode of address very naturally. So had Tom and Alice.
Thank you.
Yes, Alice said. Thanks. I've never eaten two burgers in my life, at least not big ones like that.
It was 3 o'clock the following afternoon. They were on the back porch of Cheatham Lodge. Charles Ardai, the head, as Jordan called him, had grilled the hamburgers on a small gas grill. He said the meat was perfectly safe because the generator powering the cafeteria's freezer had run until noon yesterday. And indeed, the patties he took from the cooler Tom and Jordan had carried in from the pantry had still been white with frost and as hard as hockey pucks. He said that grilling the meat would probably be safe until 5 o'clock, although prudence dictated an early meal.